This is Julie Pearson, Little Thunder. Today is November 2nd, 2012, and I'm interviewing Manisa Crumbo at her husband Jim Halsey's office in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Manisa, you're an artist who grew up around Native art. Your father, Woody Crumbo, is a celebrated artist, and you're also a supporter of women's art and have spent much of your life thinking about tribal spiritual traditions, those of yours, people and other people. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
You're welcome, Julie. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm honored.
Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I lived here until I was 7 years old, and then the family moved to Taos, New Mexico.
Your mother was Muscogee Creek, and she was a school teacher who also painted watercolor painting.
Mm-hmm.
How did she impact you growing up?
Well, she gave me a love of learning and reading that endures to this day. She gave me a love of education. She was an educated woman. She valued that from the very beginning. And she always brought me books home from teachers' meetings, things like that. It's right from Dick and Jane, I was with the reading agenda.
How about your father? What was his influence on you growing up?
Well, of course, I sat by his side and earlier than that on the floor when he was working, because he always, nearly always had a home studio. So it was just a part of my environment. He influenced me in that I really grew up with that as my predominant worldview.
Right. Was your brother artistically inclined?
Like he's a fabulous silversmith.
Now, your father was Citizen Potawatomi, but he was also raised by Muscogee Creek people, I think.
For a few years.
Would you say that cultural influence was a little more dominant in your life growing up?
I would say that the Pan-Indian experience, a very much of a culturally bilocated experience, is what influenced me more than anything. And by culturally bilocated, I mean not only pan-Indian, but also dominant society and Indian cultures. So I have a lot of influences. I'm also mixed blood. I have Scots, Irish, and German tribal influences that run deep and strong in me that I value very highly.
Were you close to your grandparents on your mother's side? Did you?
Very close to them.
What are your memories of them?
Well, I have a lot of memories. They lived on the farm. They weren't on the original allotment, but they were close to it. And like a lot of Oklahoma populations in the 1940s, they were still on the farm and completely rural. They had wagon and a team of horses that they hitched up when they went to Shakota or to Pierce, and the only cash income was from 40 acres of pecans and some cattle that my grandfather raised. They never had indoor plumbing or electricity. They grew all their own food, and so I grew up in a great deal of that atmosphere, and I was there for some of what were the last butcherings. At a certain point, the family had a huge smokehouse because they had to get through the winter and cared for a few other hands. They had a 3-room smokehouse. Having smoked myself, I can tell you it takes a lot of room to fill 3 rooms. But there's a lot of processes that are involved within it. That was very valuable. There was a vineyard. Of course, there was a huge garden, lots of canning. Grand made her own soap, grew their own corn and the food for the animals, had hogs, chickens, milk cow, made their own butter, buttermilk, dairy products. There was a spring, a well spring that the water came from. You know, it was completely close to the land. I value it.
Wonderful experiences. What is the first piece of art that you have a really distinct memory of when you were young? When you sort of become conscious of the fact that I'm looking at a piece of art?
Oh my, what would that have been? To look at, I think I would have to back it up a little bit to a piece of art that I experienced before I knew it was art. And that would be the Peyote Ceremony mural that's in the Philbrook Museum. I was about 3 years old when our father was working on that, 3 or 4, and he worked on it at night when the public wasn't there. So I would go over with him and be present while that was going on. And I remember getting lost in the Philbrook. There wasn't anyone there.
Exciting,
yeah.
To be in a big museum.
Well,
scary.
It was scary. I was calling around and running. Running and calling for him. And so he came up and got me. So that probably marks my experience more, because I really noted what he was doing then when he had to come up and get me. So,
right.
Yeah.
Wow. What is your first memory of making art yourself?
Art. What is art? That's what it brings my thoughts around too. I don't really classify art as an activity. It's more of a connection with spirit and the combination and unification of mind, heart, body, spirit, connecting with spirit energy, which then infuses whatever it is that we do. So I would say probably digging in the earth was my connection, my first connection, and then handling the material, because art by its definition then has to have a material, a physical property. And I would say mine was just first a handful of clay, earth, or sand.
At your folks' house or grandparents' house?
At my grandparents' house, in front of that the house, there was a spring that went by. People still stopped to get water there.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you moved to Taos when you're around 6. What was the reason for the move?
Well, our father had asthma, like that. Not quite asthma. He had respiratory problems that were aggravated by the humidity. You relate? Yeah. So, and the pollens and things like that. So he had traveled out there before and found that he was able to live and breathe much more clearly out there, aside from loving the area and knowing a lot of people out there at that point. And then, of course, he had taken Thomas Gilcrease out there when he was serving at the as the artist in residence at the Gilcrease Foundation in the mid-40s. They traveled out there, and Thomas Gilcrease purchased a lot of materials from the Taos founders at that time. So it broadened our father's relationship with the area even more deeply. So it was a combination of health and work-oriented.
Was he still working a little bit for Gilcrease at that point when you moved or not?
No, he'd completed his work, which the body of work actually came to somewhere around 160 pieces that he did when he was in that position. And that's what will be represented in the Gilcrease Centennial Exhibition, February 2013.
Oh, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Do you happen, you were so, I don't know if you were even ever Matt Gilchrist, and you would have been so young if you did, but I just wondered if you had any memory
certainly,
of him.
Certainly. Very kind. Very nice. I have many memories of him. Now, they were, I went back and forth all the time. I wasn't in school yet, so I was around. The museum was not open yet. That was one of the reasons that our father was there, was to paint and all, help him with the and accompany him on buying trips and assist in the setting up of the museum. So his son's children I knew and played with at that time. Bart's daughter Jana and I are friends, and we connected after many, many years.
Very cool. So what are your memories of Taos and that big change from, you know, these landscapes of, you know, your grandparents' farm, northeastern Oklahoma, and Taos?
I didn't view it as that radical a change. It was just a change. I'm a Potawatomi, and Potawatomis are migrators and travelers. We trace our Anishinaabe roots back to Nova Scotia and have been following the Seven Shell prophecy for the last several hundred years, and now are gathered mostly around the shores of Lake Michigan in Indiana and Michigan. And we're still on the move when we were relocated to Kansas and Oklahoma. So I think that tradition is very alive and well in me. I regard the new with optimism and pleasure. So we traveled back here every summer and Christmas to be with the grandparents. And then eventually we had some family move to New Mexico from here. So I can't say that I experienced any separation at all. It was just an enhancement and an enrichment of an already very rich life.
What school did you attend in Taos?
Well, I went to the Taos Day School, first of all, because our mother was teaching there. She was a first grade teacher, and she was my first teacher.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Did that present any challenges in any way?
Nope. She was just my teacher. No, she didn't single me out at all. She was very professional, and it was just a wonderful experience. So I went there for 3 years, and then they moved into town, and I went to the elementary school and junior high school in Taos, New Mexico.
So you probably have some strong memories of Taos Pueblo too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind sharing a couple of those?
Well, it's a very, very deep, unique, and powerful place. And my stories are only superficial vignettes and observations from the outside, because I'm not Taos. What I do recall was in the early days, there is a guard, a person that stands guard, a man that stands guard 24/7 around the Pueblo, putting out prayers, watching the movements of the sun, the comings and goings of the people. There is a great deal of attentiveness that is very present with the people, coordinating their activities with those of the natural world. They're agrarian. They still had a granary society at that time, where they kept 7 years of grain to prepare in case of famine or drought. Very culturally oriented in terms of bringing forward a lot of the old ceremonies and the foods and living in that way. In the Pueblo itself, there's no water or power. I remember one time a friend I was talking about, his grandmother wanted to get power into her little house. which was a little ways away from the serious Pueblo grounds. And she could have gotten Bauer where she was. But her grandson looked at her and he said, "Grandma, are you sure you want to have to pay to live? They don't need money." That and my experience with my grandparents were very formative in my worldview and establishing my priorities about what it was going to take to live well, what it looked like, and what I had to do to live well, which first of all comes from establishing my relationship with the Creator, the land, family and community and tribe, and in whatever order that happens to come, and endeavoring to remain in balance and harmony and fine attunement with those things, and everything else is accessory.
Who were some other Native artists you got to know growing up?
Well, of course, I knew Bert Phillips and Joseph Henry Sharp.
Wow. They must have been a little bit
house old. Founders.
Yeah,
they were
pretty elderly.
They were
time.
Getting on up there at that mm-hmm. time. A lot of the Taos artists, Isla McAfee, let's see, there's just so many, and then a lot of the Oklahoma artists, Archie Black Owl, Black Bear Bosun, Willard Stone, just everyone that was working around her at that time that Dad came back for shows with, and he was personal friends with, and
did you think of yourself, and you've sort of kind of explained your views, you know, in the not wanting to sort of categorize in that way, but I'm wondering if you thought of yourself as an artist from a fairly young age.
No. It was just that it wasn't even hardly a identified word, because I was growing up in a community, a tricultural community at that, and everyone was had their own connection with spirit, community, the land, and it was full of art, if you will, and no one used those words. A bowl of beans and chicos that you have cooked, with maybe a little pig from your own yard and some chili that you grew, is high art.
Mm-hmm.
That's high art that feeds and nourishes the people. And the people love what they produce, and they love the simplicity of the land and the diet and the relationship of the land that it takes to bring forward a meal like that, which is no small feat. Given the vagaries of weather and the things that can happen. So there's much appreciation for that. So someone that has a gallery and is selling things for big prices on the street is viewed as on exactly the same level as the person that opens the acequias and the opens the ditches and keeps them clean and sings the songs and is up at sunrise greeting the song and the sun and the sunset, letting the sun go back into the night. Those things are on a parity that has more to do with spirit than art.
Now you did study at the Taos Academy of Fine Arts.
I did.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn there? What was that experience like?
Oh, I learned one very important thing. my teacher at a certain point, who was Ray Vanella, who I saw this last time when I was out there. He's retiring from painting now, and it was very nice to reconnect with him. But at a certain point, I said something about when I got good, or when I was beginning to think about identifying as an artist a little bit. He said, "Stop it right here." He said, "You're an artist right now." He says, "Don't ever view yourself any differently." He says, "You don't become an artist. You are an artist." And then he taught me about value. Draftsmanship has always been my first love, drawing. But he introduced the concept of color and value in some very interesting ways. He had been an artist for Disney. And he actually began painting or drawing with the famous artist course. You probably saw those in the comic books in the 50s, right? Well, I have his famous artist book series that he purchased and went through when he was in the Army. And he learned how to do that. And then he went to work for Disney. And then he came out to Taos and became a fine artist. So he was teaching about value. Value is the temperature of color. Warm or cool grade within it. And he said, "You'll understand that much." He said, "I'm going to give you a whole lot more teaching now that you won't understand, but you will later." And it went that way. At the time when he said that, I thought, well, I don't understand. So he's telling me I don't understand. I'll accept that. And then one day he said, "It's like a light bulb will go off in your head and you'll understand what I'm saying." And it went that way. It was great. So I learned to do portraits with him. And portraits are something that came down through time that I enjoyed very much. And I have one of the portraits over here that's with us today that we'll talk about a little bit later. He brought in people from the Taos Pueblo to sit for us, and one of them was a man named Joe Sandoval, called Sunhawk. And he was also a Peyote Roadman and a good friend of our father's, and his wife, Annie Sandoval, took care of us when mother was teaching and my brother was younger and wasn't in school yet, so Annie became our surrogate mother. And in recent years, we've all reconnected again, and it's been very nice to meet. Annie and Joe are gone, but the children and the grandchildren are around, and so the association comes on down through time. So we're coming into something of a story here. And I would like to interject something here.
Sure.
Of the spirit of the story. It's one thing to read a story, and it's another thing to write a story. I attended a gathering last night that Inscott Momaday was there at, and he began right on target with me, right online, saying that he was at the confluence of evolution, prayer, and story. And I said, I'm all about this. I'm there. And then went on to give a wonderful evening. And it reminded me of the chapter that I wrote for the Gilcrease book on the Taos years. And I was moved to write something about the story. And I would like to contribute this to the interview and introduce and shift into yet another of your gears of storytelling of life, as oral tradition is actually story, and the story of life is a precious thing that you were doing in order to preserve that history and that message for posterity. So if I may take a moment, I'd like to read a paragraph that I included in the Taos chapter of the Gilcrease book on Witty Crumbo about the nature of the story as I see it. Stories are what keep us alive. When spirit ways unite with the mind and the body, we connect with our divinity. A story is a spirit way, a sacred thing, and must be told with the greatest accuracy and the highest integrity. The storyteller and the listener must both be ready and move along at the same pace. To tell a story well is to engage in a ceremony. Stories are what keep us alive.
That's wonderful. Thank you for reading that.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
So what path, after studying at the Taos school there, the Art Institute, and I'm not sure how old you were, but I'm just wondering what you did after that. Were you a teenager at that point? Or?
No, I was in my early 30s.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could just go back a little bit and follow your journey from the time that you graduate from school, I guess. And would that have been in New Mexico?
No, it was in El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So and Mount Pleasant, Utah. Yeah. Well, I married and I had my children, my lovely children, Woodrow Rexford Carter and Christine Heather Carter. And then in the early 70s, we moved to Taos, and that's when I enrolled in the TAFA, Taos Academy of Fine Art, and studied with Ray Vanilla and Ron Barsano. I studied color, draftsmanship, portraiture, art theory. It was a very eclectic program, and unfortunately all too short because of life changes and both of the teachers' lives. The Taos Academy closed, and I applied to School of Visual Arts in New York City and went immediately there to study, which was a very interesting experience. I loved being in New York at that time. I met a lot of people. It was a very rich experience. The school experience was very interesting and rich as well. But I found that it was the personal experience of the city and the people that I met there, and some of the workshops and the things that I took at the Society of Illustrators and some places like that that were most valuable for me. And just the larger experience of the world. Because I already had a wonderful underpinning, spiritual underpinning, and instruction from my father and other teachers.
Were you in New York, what was your style and sort of subject matter when you went in?
It was the same. It was draftsmanship and painting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And were portraits sort of a focus already then, too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They really let us follow our own subjects. Some of the classes were more specific than others. There was a Spider-Man class. Who was the creator of Spider-Man? And Spider-Man was just getting big. And he was on staff, and I monitored some of his classes. I would walk by, and he was so full of information. He was a dynamic communicator and teacher. And I just went in and soaked up what he had to say, because it's all relevant in art. Yeah. Harvey Dinnerstein was a famous illustrator in the city. I had a class with him. Worked with live models in a large studio with windows, black and white, silver point. Learned a lot of new and interesting techniques. There was a lot of experimental filmmaking, pre-video days while I was there. So in my off time, I caught some of that. It was very interesting.
Now, were you Did you connect with some galleries while you were there or not? Did you have your work in any?
No, I didn't show in any galleries. There's a large population and it's only so many galleries. It's very competitive and you have to really reach a point where you are going to pay for them to take you on, and then they're probably going to take 50 or 60% commission, much more so than they do in the West. I was strictly there to study. The alternative galleries were starting up at that time. A lot of them were, at that time, where it happens. You know what I mean. There was a demonstration of the activity happening. And some of those galleries were in lofts and in undeveloped portions of the city where there was space and people could put things up. But even those people were fairly well connected and with the art scene, with the New York art scene, and they were making initial movements into kind of like the off-Broadway of galleries.
Right.
Off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway of galleries. Yeah. Yeah. So I was strictly there to learn and experience. But I did recognize that when I got back home that life for me as a professional artist was going to be infinitely easier for me than it was for those people in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them would never find gallery space and would never come in for their share of PR, would never be recognized outside of a very small area. So I didn't endeavor to compete there at all because it was not going to be my home and it wasn't my, leave them their place where they need to live and work and grow in, because I had my own place to come back to.
Mm-hmm. What was your first sale of artwork?
Probably at Gallery A, a gallery run by Mary Sanchez in Taos. I spent a number of years studying and working and wanted to reach a point where I felt like I was, I could respect my work as an artist and hopefully that it would have a broader appeal, broad enough appeal to sell. So I held back with looking for a gallery until I felt like I reached that point. Then I took my portfolio around and she liked what she saw and took a chance on me and paid my rent for years.
That's wonderful. So this was when approximately, what? 73, mm-hmm.
74, 75, 76, mm-hmm. 77, like that.
Were any of your children living there too? Then,
off and on. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with their father in Denver and sometimes with me.
Mm-hmm. And how did your dad respond to some of the directions you were taking in art? Was he passed on by then or?
No, okay. He wasn't. No, he liked it just fine. He was not a teacher. So he really declined to say anything about what anyone did because he recognized it as a process. He did teach a few times, off and on. It was always when he was living someplace else and I didn't have the opportunity to sit with him. And at that time, when he devoted himself to doing that, he was a superb instructor. And a person that really wanted to put a lot into their work and spend a lot of time with it could get a lot from him. If they were not willing to put time into the work that in the direction that he was giving them, they had a very hard time of it. Because they couldn't keep up, and mm-hmm. and if his direction wasn't followed, they just weren't there. They just weren't there on the same page together at all. So no, he never did say too much about what I did. each person's work is so personal. That's your relationship with the creator. I mean, you can say a little something about perspective or value or drawing, but even so, if someone's drawing or perspective or color value is off a little bit, unless you're in a classroom, ongoing classroom circumstance with them, it's going to be very hard to identify, address, get them to understand and accept what you have to say. Artists do not really want to hear what someone else has to say about their work, especially if it's a critique. And get them to make the shift and make it habitual. There's a menu, a long and a complex menu that has to do with perception, habit, that really leads one to just let a person follow their own process. If they ask for a critique and you're in a position to give a critique, you have to tread very lightly and very correctly so they can accept and grow with what you have to say. If it's not right, it'll be rejected, and whatever was not correct is there forever, probably. And you've probably lost a friend.
That's really well put.
Yeah.
You made a trip to Russia. You had an exhibition in Russia in 1979, is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, the Russians were traveling in the United States with Goss Concert, and they attended a concert of Roy Clark's, Roy Clark's invitation in Las Vegas, leading to a relationship, which brought them ultimately to Tulsa, where they saw some of my work in exhibition and asked if I would, the next time, if I would prepare for an exhibition there. So the only stipulation was that it could not be commercial at all. So, and it was in 2 years in advance. So I had to be working on a non-commercial exhibition and also keep my income coming in while mm-hmm. I prepared for that. And it was fine. It happened. And I ultimately took the 36 pieces of portraits, primarily tricultural portraits, and some poetry, which was very well received. It was at the height of the Cold War. And the misinformation was flying back and forth. The air was full of it. And they were getting the same stuff that we were, and they were just really interested in looking into the eyes of the Americans, Native American, Hispanic, and Anglo that I presented, and plumbing our depths for themselves, finding out who we were. They wanted to see for themselves. So it was very successful in that way. And they would stand before the portraits for a long time and look and look and look. Because each one of those portraits that I sent, I asked permission of the person that sat for me and if they would come and be present in that exhibition.
Mm.
And some said no and most said yes. So they were there. Wow. They were there.
So that's a wonderful dimension to that, because they're meeting
gotta
people.
Got to be real.
Yeah.
Got to be real. Otherwise, you're just looking at nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a design. If the spirit of the person isn't there, and then when I got home, I unpacked them and returned them to the sitters.
Wow.
Yeah.
A wonderful gift.
Yeah. Presented them with a painting or a drawing that was mm-hmm. framed and had been on the exhibition, and they were so glad to be back.
When and how did you meet Jim?
At an exhibition here in town.
Can you tell us a little about it? Did you notice him right away, or? Did you, being around the music business, did that impact your creative process or your creativity in any way?
Well, it was another creative field that was going on concurrently with mine. Yeah.
Gilcrease Museum gave you a solo show as well. And what was that like?
Oh, it was great. I think I had 14 pieces, and it was a group show. There were a lot of other Indian artists that were exhibiting at that time. It was a wonderful opportunity.
And with all the memories also that
Yes,
you had
yes.
of Gilcrease.
Yeah.
Did you find that your subject matter and style and palette or palette was changing at that point? Could you identify any changes or had it?
Well, I was beginning to work more in dream and vision alongside the portraits.
So there was realism and then there was. Okay.
Right, dream and vision. And the dream and vision were executed in a flat line and color instead of the three-dimensional classical European studio style.
I know that you and Jim also attended some native art shows and collected some work. Why was that important to you?
Well, he's the one that attended most of the shows and bought. It was before we met. After that, all the money went into the household. The collecting was over. It was my things that came in. And there was plenty of art for
You
the
were
walls.
providing art.
Right.
Did you ever do any booth shows at all, or was it always
No, I didn't.
music?
I assisted and accompanied my father in a lot of booth shows. I'd never been that prolific and never produced multiples. You have to have a lot of multiples. You can't just have originals up there. There's just not that many. So, our father worked a lot with silk screens and etchings, especially the silk screens, or which what people are so familiar with.
How big a part of your art have commissions been over the years?
Not very big. I don't like to do commissions. Someone really has to have their own relationship with something that I've already done. I don't work to direction.
Well, one of the portraits that I did see was the one you did of Renard Strickland, the writer and legal scholar, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful portrait.
I have
So,
it right here.
oh.
In the exhibition at the Fred Jones. No, I don't usually work to. This was
Yes, thank you
a
for showing
friendship
it.
piece that we did here.
Were there any challenges to doing that?
No.
I think that relationship really translates in that.
Whenever I did portraits in the past of someone, I never took commissions, and if they liked it, fine, and if they didn't, it was mine.
Besides creating art, have you done any judging of art shows?
Don't do that. Absolutely not. No, my father gave me two pieces of advice at a certain point. He said, when you reach a certain point in your career, don't participate in judge shows. Because if you don't make it, then people will say, well, so and so can't make the show anymore, or they weren't accepted or whatever. Just forget that And don't judge your fellow's art, because you'll make an enemy of everyone but the first three awardees. They will not understand, and just don't do it. So I did once, and I was really sorry, because it was true.
Was it here in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not a good thing. Let someone impartial, someone who's not connected with the community, do that. Mm-hmm. Big mistake to sit in judgment of your fellows. Mm-hmm. Anytime, really.
Mm-hmm.
Big lesson there.
You have friends who are women artists, men artists. Can you talk a little bit about, and very eclectic, as you said, approach to art yourself. Can you talk a bit about some of the things you appreciate about the work of women artists that you've become friends with?
I'd rather talk about my work as a female artist.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And let the work speak for themselves. I taught traditional women's ways for many years, and I had a lot of art come out from that. So for me, my work as where I happen to be differentiated as a female in this world of duality gives me a unique worldview of creation, and so the teachings came out of that, and the art came out of that. So in that way, each person's work speaks of their personal relationship with their with the creator and the family, their gender affiliations and experiences. So so my work is in traditional women's ways is uniquely feminine and female in that it talks about and addresses the blood mysteries, which is the way that as women we are grounded and seek and forge and manifest power through our personal power and relationship, power being our relationship with the Creator, through our biology. So that is the definition of every person's relationship with art. And if you happen to be a female, that is our story, but it's also the other side of the story, because it's a gift to the side of the story that it's not the story of.
Mm-hmm.
So both ways, always blended gender, masculine, feminine, are very, very important, because ultimately from whence we came, we shall return, and we are spirit beings and living in a physical body which is defined by masculine or feminine definitions, and ephemeral by its definition. Because we are spirit beings. Right now we're differentiated and enjoying that dance, enjoying the beauty of that dance. But it's always desirable to bring it back into fine attunement and to be in touch with our masculine and feminine inner. And that is the true marriage. The true marriage that's spoken of in the marriage ceremony is really each person's marriage with their inner masculine or feminine. And it's spoken of in the physical marriage ceremony that the two shall become one. Well, that's where it comes from, is here. Spirit that comes together and becomes one there. And then it's metaphored out into the physical world. And when a person meets that center and comes in and engages in whatever ceremony or observation or prayer that they do, then they are renewed and restored and have gifts and energy and of harmony and balance to take out to the world through the left or the right, the masculine or the feminine, back into duality to make our contribution. That's it in a nutshell about my work with traditional women's ways. I did offered sweat lodge and dance opportunities and ceremony, and I was trained by had some very fine medicine teachers. Marcellus Bearhart Williams was of the Muscogee Creek tribe, was my first teacher that gave me an exceptional grounding in universal and non-judgmental love for all beings, and grounded that teaching very well for me, which I'm carrying on to this day.
When did you start that into teaching? Was that in your 40s or?
30s.
In your 30s at mm-hmm. the same time?
Mm-hmm. Who was a friend of our father's?
Mm-hmm.
And a distant blood relative.
Mm-hmm. But when you yourself began teaching traditional women's ways about the same time,
mm-hmm.
exploring it.
Mm-hmm. And
have you worked around the country a little bit,
mm-hmm.
workshops around?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Extensively.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd like to add that is that traditional women's ways are universal ways. If you bleed, you're a traditional woman. If you breathe, you're a traditional woman. If you eat, sleep, drink, no one has a lease on the word traditional. We're universal.
What?
Traditional just has its own particular definition that that someone wants to bring forward and share and say, you know, this is our tradition, but it's not the only one. And the deepest grounded traditional traditions that we have come from the mind of creation.
In what ways do you think maybe your teaching has influenced your painting a bit, or maybe vice versa?
Well, it would be vice versa. I was already quite, I brought more into it. I have not developed the teachings of the women's ways into paintings as much as the painting tradition came into that, simply because holding energy for the teachings 24/7 put me in service to the teaching and not as a painter. I've not painted professionally for 30 years. I've been teaching. And I get a little bit in here and there, but you have to make some choices about how you're going to spend your time and express mm-hmm. yourself. And
that's been the art you've been focusing on.
Right, right. I went back to school a couple of years ago and picked up a course in silversmithing with Bradley Oliver, who was a teacher at TTC, fine silversmith here in town, fine. And I had the pleasure of sitting with him for a year and receiving his support. I sat with my brother earlier and worked with him in the studio there, but Bradley's the one that drew me through the keyhole. Yeah. And a very exacting, and which was just, it's wonderful. You have to have someone, hopefully, that knows exactly what they're doing and asks you to do only that and nothing less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you get it. So so I've been on a high learning curve the last number of years. I moved into video documenting artists and creative people myself. And yes? Are we coming to an end?
Let's just pause. I understand you've been interested in documenting the work of artists with video, other artists.
Yes, I'm very much interested in that. It really started so many years ago when I was doing the portraits. I would just draw whoever was in my life, and if they passed into my living room, I was likely to ask them if they'd sit for me, and I always had my materials handy and I'd pull it out and do a drawing. So it's the same thing. So that's it just depends on who's in my life, and I've always got the camera in the car. It's in the car now. No. I may not use it very much for a long period of time, but I want to have it now. And now, thank goodness for iPhone cameras, they're just great.
Oh, yeah.
No, but you can't really, and I carry a little microphone around with me too. So I appreciate your work. I know you have a lot of fun with it. And do you do your own editing?
No, Juliana.
Hooray. But you sit beside her when she does some editing, I suppose. And it's so nice if you don't have to do both. Well, it's like the painting and the teaching. It really comes down to one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
They're two necessary but specific talents.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very time consuming.
Right.
Yeah.
In 2006, the Oklahoma History Center hosted a Crumbo Spirit Talk. Can you tell us how that came about?
The 2006.
All right, I've got the wrong date. I'm thinking of this year, actually, I think.
12.
Yes, 2012. Yes. Sorry about that.
Well, this year is our father's centennial year. He would have been 100. So there's some things going on.
Yes.
And that History Center, Dr. Bob Blackburn, asked if I would be interested in doing something with him, and I had kind of thought that maybe this 100-year anniversary was just going to go on through and be privately noted and marked. Uh-huh. But I was interested, of course, in doing what I could to honor our father and his contribution to the world in whatever way that I could, and very appreciative of the interest and the opportunity that Dr. Blackburn brought forward. So I produced a lot of things from our collection and made them gallery ready and worked with their wonderful establishment. The show opened in January of 12, which is our father's birthday, and it's up for a year and a half, actually.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. And the exhibitions are going to change quarterly because they have a lot of artwork and not all of it can be shown at once. So they asked that it be a family show. So there's some of my father's work. Most of the bulk of it is his. Some of my brother's jewelry work and up to 30 of my pieces.
Oh, great.
Some of it from the black and white images from A Sweet Call, Alive in a Living World, which is relevant to the traditional women's ways teachings.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
which are actually illustrations for the book that I'm working on now, entitled The Lost Female Fire.
Do you feel like talking about that a little bit, the book that you're working on now?
I can talk about it as much as I can talk about it. Yeah. The development areas are tender and sensitive and in development and I really can't tell you what they're about now because they're I've been working on the book a number of years, and I'm going to come out with a short chapter or two the first of the year. Because it's turning into a tome. There's quite a lot, so I think that I'm in the selection process of something to bring out now.
Mm-hmm.
It's something of a blood mysteries manual, if you will.
Mm.
That's a little sensational way to put it, but in a way, we're all seeking the sensation of linkage with our deepest selves and the Creator. We all want to be We all want to die and be reborn to spirit. In ceremony and in a sacred way. And ceremony allows a person to do that without having to get into risky social behavior. Yeah. Risky or questionable or whatever. So our biology and the fact that we have a moon time event once a month when we're in our childbearing years offers us the opportunity to meet the sacred charge as it was given to me. And to meet it and to experience it, live it out, and satisfy it to the larger community, ourselves in the larger community. The larger community meaning all of us. Because a powerful spirit action that a person undertakes when it's satisfied is actually in service to and a gift to all of creation. It doesn't, who knows where it stops. What happens for the one happens for the all. And as women, we have a sacred charge to move through and live with our moon time in a particular way, going to retreat. I was instructed for a year in how to do this. There's a lot of information. And it's not something that we have to go out of our home to do. It's a way that is non-competitive with the larger society, in that the larger society in this case being the fact that most of us as women have to interface with a lot of men in our world. And that's fine, but we have a women's way too, which isn't identified or brought forward very often. And it takes us out of that competitive arena, and the men love it. They love it when we find our power and our beauty and come forward and bring something of our own forward. They love it. They've been waiting for us to do it. We got sideways with it so many years ago, so long ago, to our detriment. And now we're crying around about it because we don't have our way and we're trying to make it in the men's world. So it's kind of like two steps forward, one step back, some people might say, because they say, well, how am I going to continue to function in the world? Well, do it and you'll find out. Because it's different for each person. Yeah. Because those gifts come from the Creator, not from us. But we have to put ourselves in the way of the Creator's energetic path that was provided for us.
Sometimes there's an attitude of, we have these ways of knowing and they're really ours and we don't need to. Or there's that attitude, and then there's, well, these ways, you know, aren't pertinent to you anymore, so you all don't need to know about them. There's different, you know, attitudes towards teaching, I guess, of traditional.
Well, what
ways
are we talking about when we say ways?
What's
that mean?
Right.
What's the word there?
Right.
When the word ways is, do you know what you're talking about to me? Right. When you say those ways aren't any, do you know what ways you're even referring to?
Right.
They don't know. I call that the Tampax mentality. Oh, you don't need to do that anymore. You don't, you know, that's out. That didn't go very deep.
Yeah.
We'll stop right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess just another question real quickly. So you don't go into this is your political commitment too, is to the spiritual. You're not really, are you interested in activist politics at all or not?
Totally not. We have our hands full, and we're not doing that. If we were doing that, our political profile might be different. If the men were vision questing, if the men had ceremonies to, mm-hmm. Men don't have ceremonies to do. You know, we're so fortunate. We carry our biology, we carry our ceremony within us. Mm-hmm. The women go in, the men go out. Men have always been the ones to carry the ceremony, and the commercial world and the world of competition and the speed of which we live has been so penalizing for all of us.
You know, I read a quote of your father's about how important stories are, and you read us that wonderful writing, piece of writing that you've done for the catalog. And I'm wondering if at this point in your life, your father's story is even more central to you now than it was in the past, or...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely it is. Yeah, I would say honoring him in his centennial year is no small thing for all of us. And that's one of the things that it's been my pleasure to participate in, is bringing that out for everyone and finding out it was for me too.
Yeah.
Well, because he spoke from the other side. He brought, his works are about our beautiful physical world of duality as we know it, that is infused and suffused with the mind of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And to remember that, and to see that, to rest there, and to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Draw some peace, some wisdom, some quiet,
mm-hmm.
some love.
Besides painting, have you tried your hand at any of the... what they call the traditional arts, but I'm thinking of like sewing or weaving.
A quilter. Mm. I'm a potter. Mm. A basket maker. A pie maker. A gardener.
And a bit of a silversmith.
Right.
In terms of Native art, where do you see that moving today? And I don't know how much you're out at the shows these days, but where do you see that going?
It's not so much where it's going as where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't have an overview on that. I would just say, you know, it depends so much on where you are and who you're looking at, and then just have a look at that and enjoy that. Almost any artist will have something to say about a piece, but they won't say very much, because we recognize that the person's experience with the artwork is unique and their own, and it belongs to them. Mm-hmm. And they can be told a story or hear a story about it, but their experience is the valid one.
Mm-hmm. Was there any process for you? I'd like to talk just a little bit about the process and techniques of painting, and I know you've been spending quite a bit of your time, as you explained, and just getting to your painting periodically. But was there a process for you with your signature? Sometimes that's something artists wrestle with. The placement of it, how big it is, how to sign. Did you ever...
Well, you don't want to draw too much attention to the signature.
Mm-hmm.
So I bring it down to a name, mm-hmm. probably. It's more professional to not draw that much attention to it, size-wise, color-wise, length-wise, placement, and all that comes with instruction, because we're all like the beginning. We're all like kids. And the teacher will come by and say, all I see is your name. Tone it down.
Good point.
Yes.
When you do paint, get to painting, are you working in oil sometimes, or is it mostly water media?
Oil.
Oil.
I like oil a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm working a little bit more in watercolor because oil is a demanding mistress. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially if you work large. Mm-hmm. It takes an enormous amount of energy to... And I like to work the size large enough that I can walk into. Mm. And I'm finding that I'm really enjoying working smaller now, more with watercolor, which is very immediate. I like the transparency of it, all mm-hmm. of the qualities of watercolor. But my first love is probably draftsmanship, and then oil, mm-hmm. and then watercolor.
So do you keep a sketchbook?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You probably had a couple.
Mm-hmm. I took one to Egypt.
Over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, I was wondering if you'd just talk, you know, a little briefly maybe about one or two trips that were highlights for you besides the trip to Russia, which...
Egypt was big. I elected not to take a camera on that trip.
Mm.
And I forced myself, an 8.5 by 11 sketchbook bound hardcover, and all my pencils and razor blades, good drawing pencils. You don't put in a sharpener. You have to use a razor blade to sharpen them. So, and the erasers, I had all that with me, and I was I regretted it almost every day, that I had to work instead of get the camera out and snap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then, on a trip like that, it's happening every day, and you see so much, and then have to work very fast because mm-hmm. it's passing scenes for the most part. So, after a while, I stopped regretting it when I realized that I was polishing a skill that was
mm-hmm.
through necessity, and I was getting a lot of things done. I did tomb rubbings,
wow.
and some of the pyramids, and made a lot of notes and drawings of people that I met along the way. It was a wonderful experience. Now when I look back through it, it's with awe. And that, and so happy that I listened to myself at the time and forced myself not to take a camera and
mm-hmm.
and work through the resistances, early resistance to working.
Right.
Just, you know, it's a fine line between taking time off and just going and doing work. But I made a decision to make it a working trip in that way.
Was this in the 90s or?
No, it's in the 70s.
70s, okay. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, when Jim went to Russia with Roy Clark, my brother and daughter and I were taking off for Rome. And so we spent the winter in Rome and went on down to Egypt and traveled around. And,
how wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Then we met back up when we got back. But we had only met once before we made that trip. And then we both just had wildly divergent. Our life took us in wildly divergent directions for a while, a couple of months.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
What's your creative process when you are engaged in painting? What's your creative process starting from the time you get your idea?
Well, it depends. It depends on the medium in part. It depends on the medium. I've been a serious student of the energetics of stones, And so that was part of the, my silversmithing and my, and it, so it depends on whether I need instruction first. Then making the dedicated time and the disciplining my mind toward being aware of what my interests, what's coming into my interest field, and noting it and filing it in a place where I begin to notice if things accumulate. I may have a lot of fields around me, but if something comes up I'm very interested in, I actually I don't file it. I put it into an area around me somewhere, not too far away. And if three things accumulate there that are connected, and something else comes in, oh, this is about that too. And I'll put it over there if I don't have anything more to do with it. And then when a third thing comes in, I pull the other two up and I say, okay, let's look. We have three things that have come here together. And when that happens, I need to be ready to start right then. Whether it's a poem or a story or a painting or a sketchbook or a thought, I need to be writing because the inspiration and creative energy has revealed itself and come together then, no more than 20 minutes. If I am driving or something and I have to put it off, I pull over to the side of the road in 20 minutes and I do some writing or something like that. That's the way it often goes. Can't put it off. It's not going to be there tomorrow in the same way. It's here now. And so, tomorrow, you can put it off till tomorrow, but it's going to have evolved and become something else. And you have to do a little work toward picking up, going back to that original point and picking up that energy that moved between. And you can, usually. But usually, what we're tempted to do is just when we get to tomorrow, skate off into the horizon then and take it from there, right? And not do the back work and go back and say, and stop everything. I like to do that now, actually. But I used to be aware that I didn't want to look back and connect with that point and bring it forward. It was way too exciting to, oh, I finally got to it. I'm gonna get out my paints and I'm gonna paint something right now. And it's a little farther down the road. And it catches up with you. But
Yeah, that's a good description.
yeah.
Well, looking back on your teaching, your art, the many things you've been doing over the years so far, what was a fork in the road that seems really meaningful to you now that you could have sort of taken one path and you took this different path?
Anything a little more specifically that you want to, that you're asking about?
Just sort of where you went with your art and your teaching. Do you remember any forks in the road that seemed like big, like you were making a leap, sort of, or committing yourself to one thing as opposed to the other? It can be about either one of those.
Well, I suppose they're all that way. To some degree or another. Because working with spirit is, it's always evolving. And it's always a prayer. And it's always the emerging story. And it's always risky.
What's been
Because you don't know from one moment to the next when you hold, when one thought comes or one, and you move into that. One thing that artists often know is that we're not in very much of any control. It's all risky. And we have to be prepared to love that excitement. If you got a brush and you're drawing a string of watercolor across your paper, that's every centimeter is a risk. You don't know where it's going to go, what it's going to look like, what's coming forward for you to see and become aware of, what you are putting in, endeavoring to put in, and want it to be in it, and it won't behave, Or you can tighten it way down and do a real tight drawing and get in there and make it just exactly the way that you want and so forth. And you've got this perfect little thing when you finish, but it's not real vibrant. Or it is. You may find out that it's not very vibrant, or you may find out that it is very vibrant and say, "Hey, I'm going to work small and tight from this." You know, I just found out that I was working real big and loose, and what I need to do is just bear down with a fine drawing and get in there with my little brushes and do it just all perfect like that. Or vice versa, working real tight. We all tend to work tight when we start. So they're always trying to get you to loosen up. And that really didn't work for me because of my relationship with draftsmanship. I got to have the drawing. And part of that must be in my DNA from my father's example, because he made finished pencil drawings of everything you have ever seen he did. He made finished pencil drawings of, and I have them on parchment. They're exquisite. All of the etchings, all of the silk screens, all of the oil, he made full size, depending if it's the etching, it could be that size, and the silk screens like this. I study them. They're exquisite.
So unusual.
I know where my love of draftsmanship came from.
So, looking back on your life so far, is there a highlight that you'd like to talk about? We've talked about some, but is there another one we haven't mentioned?
Well, no. No. It's still unfolding. It's still exciting and a wonderful journey.
How about, has there been a low point in your career or your teaching or art that?
Well, all of the risks are made of highs and lows. Yeah, it's the highs and lows are not unlike duality, though, and the seasons, all of that. It's just another facet of reality as you see it and as it is momentarily. Because the moment something is seen and recognized, it moves, has the opportunity to move into dynamic change, and then it's over, it's down the road. So, you don't have the highs without the lows. When you draw the line and that risk is being taken, success and failure is in that draw. I mean, highs and lows, artists know about highs and lows. It's all about, we don't walk a middle path. No one does, really.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we take a look at your artwork?
No. I
Okay,
think
well,
we've covered it very well.
we're
Oh,
Great. Well, I'm excited to look at these images for a minute here. Okay. All right, we're looking at one of your early oils, is that right?
this is this one, Philbrook took the Philbrook Award in 75 at the
At the Indian Annual.
Indian Annual.
Wow.
And the original then was purchased by the Heard Museum in Phoenix, and it's in their collection.
Oh, wonderful. And you talked about your model for that, and yeah. Okay. This piece.
Well, okay, this one is entitled Little People. Are you taping? Want me to read this? Okay. This is entitled The Little People. This was the cover art for a show at Carnegie Hall in 1976 that Jim Halsey took to New York, a first. country music presentation in Carnegie Hall. The poem goes like this. The brotherhood of all spirits, the wisdom of the land, the blossoming of each spirit, the search for, the recognition of, and the expression of the beauty and truth in each of these things. Let each one of us radiate our love, each in our own way, and may our path be richer for each one's gift. The gift of sound, the gift of song, the gift of touch, the gift of labor, of children and dreams and warm rays of sun, of trees in the wind and blue shadows on the snow, sunset skies and innocence.
That's very nice, thank you. And this was, is that gouache? Or
that's watercolor.
Watercolor.
Yeah, it's just a pink watercolor.
All right.
Yeah. That was a Playbill cover.
Yes. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.